This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
A warning, this episode contains discussion of sex. The series Mary and George tells the story of a scheming woman and her ambitious son who clawed their way up through the court of Britain's King James I, and in the case of the son at least, into the king's bed. The series stars Julianne Moore and Nicholas Galitzine, and it's packed with seduction, vicious intrigue, and ruthless political intrigue. I'm Glenn Weldon, and today we're talking about the Starz series Mary and George on Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR.
Support for NPR and the following message come from FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming only on Hulu. This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy: family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy. Support for NPR and the following message come from the American Cancer Society. Dr. Alpa Patel leads a team that researches cancer risk factors, and she shares how her team makes an impact.
We always do what we like to think of as actionable science. So the work that we do makes its way to things like nutrition and physical activity guidelines for cancer.org, where millions of people come each year to learn about how they can better prevent cancer.
To learn more, go to cancer.org.
Joining me today is Christina Tucker. She's the co-host of the podcast Wait, Is This a Date? Hey, Christina, welcome back.
Hello, Glenn. Happy to be here.
Happy to have you. Also with us is Jeffrey Masters. He's the host of the podcast LGBT Q&A and senior producer at the New Yorker Radio Hour. Welcome back, Jeffrey.
Hey, thank you.
Mary and George stars Julianne Moore as Mary Villiers, a low-born 17th century woman who recognizes that her handsome, pillow-lipped son George could seduce the king and become his favorite. George is played by Nicholas Galitzine. King James is played by Tony Curran. Mary knows that George's status as the king's lover and trusted advisor would advance her station in life.
And a new friend tells me there are openings for cupbearers.
You want me to hold a man's cup while he swallows?
I'll leave the specifics to you, but it's not a man. It's a king.
Standing in Mary's way is centuries of tradition, personified by lots and lots and lots of men, including the king's current favorite, Somerset, played by Laurie Davidson. Over the course of 7 episodes, Mary and George clash and conspire, scheme and strike as courtly politics constantly shift beneath their feet. Carefully planned alliances rise and fall as characters trade scathing barbs, and if the sheer amount of sex being had is any indication, trade a fair number of STIs as well. Mary and George is inspired by a true story. It was created by playwright and screenwriter D.C. Moore. It is now airing on Starz with a Z. Christina, kick us off. What do you make of it?
Look, I think you have to know that this is kind of made in a lab for me. I mean, we've got Julianne Moore being so mean to everyone who crosses her path.
If I were a man and I looked like you, I'd rule the planet.
We've got a pillow-lipped, handsome son pouting prettily in places all over the world.
I don't want to rule the planet.
Then it will rule you.
We've got drama. If there is a corner, don't worry. Someone is going to be lurking in it. I think it's very fun.
There you go.
And I think it is probably like my platonic ideal of what a show of this kind of nature can be. It's like biting and witty and a little silly, but grounded enough that you're still like, I am watching something that has a serious perspective, even if it is a little bit LOL.
Uh-huh. Okay, Christina, as ever, we are of one mind. How about you, Jeffrey? Where'd you come down?
Yeah, I agree about all that. You know, the first episode started and it was goofy and like borderline camp. And I didn't actually know what was going on when they went to France for this like bisexual retreat. But then the show just kind of like completely won me over by the end of it. So I'm fully on board. I thought it was a lot of fun and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah. Okay. Unanimous. This is my jam, right?
Yeah.
Look, if the first thing you do whenever you look up any historical figure on Wikipedia is scroll down to personal life.
Of course.
This is the show for you, because I don't need to tell you folks, but as queer folk, we've always had to deal with the some historians, right? Some historians suggest that their deep friendship may have had romantic overtones. And then you're like, oh, well, that's intriguing. And then every time you go to read the actual letters and it's like, mount me, stallion. And you're like, come on. Why? What are we even pretending? What? It's right there, guys. It's right there.
The tone is quite over, I would say on that.
The tone is quite over.
Yeah.
Or they'll try to say, oh, it was very common for men to share a bed at the time and travel together to Mykonos and write letters about licking each other's toes. And you're like, I don't think it was.
Wow.
So for that reason, and for many others, I was in from the jump because we talked about it, but those first few episodes just fly by. Everyone is biting and vicious and withering. If you're going to give me Untucked as historical drama, I will sop it up with a big old sop. And I was kind of taken in by the production design at first because it was promising masterpiece theater, but the engine of the show is Love Island, right? And so people compare it to The Great a lot, and I get that. I would compare it to The Great, too. If you like The Great, you're going to like this. And just on a script level, you know, scenes begin and end exactly when they need to. Nothing gets lingered over. That episode you're talking about, Jeffrey, with George going off to France, he goes off to France at the beginning of the episode, basically, and I'm like, well, okay, here's the episode. Let's settle in. I'll get a snack. Oh, no, he's back.
Yeah, that was
he's
so
back.
Speedy.
And he's already shtupping the king.
He got there and threw up and was like, yep, you're hot. I love to dance. And then left. And I was like, okay, we're moving on quickly. We have more to tell you.
We are moving it along. Yeah. But here's my question. Christina, as the series goes on, inevitably, relationships get more complicated and layered and alliances shift and the show grows. I mean, you say the word grounded. I would say a little bit more somber, right? Did you miss, as the series progresses, did you miss some of that energy of the beginning, that crispness, that archness, that if it's not camp, it's camp adjacent quality, or did you stick with it as the tone gets darker?
I stuck with it as the tone got darker, mostly to continue to watch Julianne Moore kiss women, but also because I think it is interesting from like a script perspective that it does kind of, you know, you have this very joyful, very campy kind of experience of the palace and of the way the king is running the palace in the beginning. And then you slowly start to see this kind of like these two come in. You get to see like they're not subtle with their metaphors. Like it's rot. Like rot has entered the court. That is what is occurring.
Yep.
I did kind of miss the fun of it, of the whimsy and the, you know, many hunting parties and playing instruments and all of that. But I was kind of like, this does make sense. These are not great people. I get it.
Yeah.
They're bummers.
Yep.
Yeah, I think that tone shift is necessary because, like, I mean, we were saying, this is following Queen Elizabeth. This period in history has been written about so much. I'd never heard anything about it. Had y'all heard anything about this kind of story, like, whispered?
I had, like, a vague familiarity. Like, I was like, yes, I recognize this as historical, but not deeper.
You're much smarter than me. I get it. But for me, the first couple episodes of, like, camp and goofiness, the novelty of, oh, my God, the queerness in this historical moment was so exciting. And then the novelty wears off. And that's when, like, the tone shifted. And I thought it was, like, a necessary shift to keep me involved and, like, entertained.
Yeah, that makes sense, too.
A groundedness, yeah. I mean, like, I get that. I mean, you always worry in historical fiction if it's more beholden to contemporary attitudes than historical accuracy. You know, I hear myself say that. I don't care about that.
Yeah, me neither.
Because, you know, because, you know, so much queer history has been erased that I'm happy to kind of tuck it into places it may not have originally existed. Do I think that Mary Villiers had a sex worker lover, here played by Neve Alger as Sandy?
Have you ever been with a girl before? Bodies are just bodies.
Or do I think the writers wanted to queer things up a bit, maybe overcorrect for centuries of erasure? Doesn't matter. I'll take it where I get it. But where do you guys stand on that notion of accuracy versus modern sensibility?
Yeah, I think like the amateur queer historian in me who has read history books on gay history over two. No, I think, sorry, I sound so dumb.
Huge humble brag.
I've read books. Okay. The amateur wannabe historian in me appreciated that they didn't try to make this like a fully modern queer story. So like in this kind of way of life, it was like combined with and overlaid with other like traditional things like having a wife and kids. And that I found so interesting that like the queer identity in this space. Mm-hmm. Like you said, there was this, you know, lesbian relationship that they may be forced in there, but I thought we had both, like pushed and not pushed.
Yeah, I think for things like period shows like this, the historical accuracy, at some point I am kind of like, if I want historical accuracy, I'm going to like find a, you know, a document about this. If I'm going to be watching famous people who are famous because they are very pretty and charismatic, like, let's be a little fun. Like, let's have some fun with this. Like, I don't think we need to stick to, you know, the exact rules. But I think my ruling on that changes kind of daily. There are some things where I'm like, well, that's not how that happened. I can't accept it. This I can, you know, I don't know that I have a really reasonable or understandable metric on that.
But let's also like put our cards on the table. When we say historical accuracy, after this, I went and watched the Saoirse Ronan movie with Margot Robbie, Mary Queen of Scots, because Mary Queen of Scots is the mother of King James. And so that's the kind of like level of like work I turned to like learn more about history, right? It was a Margot Robbie movie. So I don't know if I can call myself a historian. I take that back.
I think you should, frankly.
No, absolutely.
I think it's
okay,
important
I take
too.
That back again. Yeah. Then, Martin.
The one thing that I was wary of is it just seemed like everybody at court was treating the fact that the king had all these male lovers, very matter-of-factly. But that was it, right? Mm-hmm. Behind the king's back, everyone was a jerk and everyone was plotting and scheming and hated him and saying really homophobic stuff. But in court, because he had power, it was just, I don't want to say accepted, but tolerated.
Yeah.
Or pretended to be tolerated.
And it was like shocking to see, frankly, in these period costumes. Mm-hmm. I'm a sucker for these kind of period costumes. It was really, frankly, exciting.
Quick note on the costumes. Everybody getting a dangly earring. Perfect. No notes. Continue.
Unreal.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. Okay. So, Julianne Moore, I'm going to look at this panel right now, and I'm going to suggest that maybe we're all already on board for any middle-aged actress in a high ruffled collar being severe. I think we're all pretty much in the tank on that. Specifically, Julianne Moore, what did she bring? What was she giving that you responded to?
I think for the Julianne Moore performance, I've never seen Julianne in this, you know, in this era or like activated in this way. It is fun to see her on like a TV program such as this. It is kind of like, Julianne, what are you doing over here? Like, get crazy with us on the TV end. But I don't know that this performance is like necessarily that emotionally different from a lot of performances she's given. But it is kind of the Julianne Moore performance that I'm always going to be in the tank for. So like, yes, give me all you got.
But if you miss this chance, you'll fail us all. And live like your father, smear the unwashable excrement of eternal shame. Bon voyage.
For sure. And she kind of like gauged herself to be a little bit more unlikable, ambitious and unlikable, but not so unlikable that it became like unbelievable that she was achieving as much as she did. So I thought that was like a clever kind of like positioning of her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I like how long they let the moments of her like feeling, even if it is like a machination that she has, you know, started to engineer, you do sit in like how uncomfortable the moment is. And you're like, this is embarrassing for you. This is an L, babe. You're going to have to take it.
Yep. There's plenty of L's. What about Nicholas Galitzine? Now, I was aware of his work from Red, White, and Royal Blue, but that performance didn't really click with me because it wasn't pitched to me, frankly. Mm-hmm. This felt queerer, and he seemed to be committing in a different way. Do you guys agree?
I think it's because, as Christina said, it was the dangly earring.
Yeah. Maybe I was right. I was distracted.
I mean that seriously. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of power in a dangly earring.
It worked for me.
Yeah, I think he's good. I mean, I think in Red, White, and Royal Blue, he is more emotionally available than perhaps the material would allow. And I think it was kind of fun to watch him in that and then immediately see him in Bottoms like later that summer and be like, wow, that's a vibe. This guy's got some stuff going on here. So I am kind of just in the tank for him. And I'm like, yeah, he's handsome. Like, I just like looking at his face. Yep. Like, it's a good looking dude. And he does the pouting and the like the, you know, kind of frustrated idiot very well. Like, he's very good at that space of like, I want this. I don't know how to get it, but I'm going to try and it's going to be bumbling and awkward and you're probably not going to like it, but you will still somehow find me likable, which is a hard thing to pull off.
Yeah, I think the casting overall I've was super into actually and very impressed by. As we said, Julianne Moore, I think that allowed them to like level up everybody else. Neve Algar, her girlfriend, is fantastic. And the king, I thought, was like giving an interesting, like, grounded performance.
Some say gallantry and all human dignity died under my reign. They whisper it, but I hear them. You're living proof that they're alive.
I thought that, yeah, I was really impressed with all the acting across the board.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Curran's a great actor, and he can bring, he does bring a groundedness, but he can also be very silly, which is kind of the vibe of this show. And you're seeing Nicholas Galitzine over the course of 7 hours, which I've never seen him in before. And so there's a lot riding on him, as it were, so to speak. And he does give you layers. He does give you levels, and he changes and grows.
I think that calling it Mary and George like is a bit of a red herring, right? Because really it's Mary and George and King James. And mm-hmm. they all have individual yeah. relationships. They're like this throuple, right? But they together and individually. And I found the show most compelling when it was dealing with the three of them together and their different tensions and conflicts there. When they separated out and just had the King and James, it was interesting. But it just didn't have the spark and the crackle of all three of them working with different desires and seeing that play out on screen.
Mm-hmm. I was even thinking I could have used like more one-on-one scenes with George and Mary together.
Are you pleased with me?
As the snake as Eve ate a dark fruit. If we tread right, George, he'll be yours. Mine. Ours.
I love their little, their mm-hmm. plotting, their machinations, their like, their vibe of distrust and calculation. I think they're very good in scenes together, and I could have used a little bit more of that. As much as I did love her coming up to him at parties and being like, "Stop complaining, sit up straight, look pretty for the king, act right, please."
Yeah, I agree with you both. There is a tension in that triangle that isn't fully exploited because they do pair mm-hmm. off, as you might imagine they would. But yeah, when the three of them are on screen together, that is when there's a lot that's unspoken that the series lets be unspoken, which is another thing I'm grateful for, because this doesn't spell it out. This doesn't have everybody telling you exactly what they're thinking every moment they're thinking it.
I just want to tell Nicola Walker personally that as Elizabeth Hatton, that I love her, and thank you for that performance. I could watch her destroy Julianne Moore at a dinner table any day of my life.
How dare you pretend he is good enough for her? And you want my inheritance to pay the dowry?
I would rather strangle her dead.
Mother.
It would be a kindness. This...
Sorry. Yes, Elizabeth Hatton is one of her mm-hmm. rivals that a lot of the fun, punchy, edgy viciousness of those early episodes is kind of resting on. That's a great performance. Well, that's our take. We want to know what you think about Mary and George. Find us at facebook.com/PCHH. And that brings us to the end of our show. Christina Tucker, Jeffrey Masters, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you.
This episode was produced by Liz Metzger and edited by Mike Katziff. Our supervising producer is Jessica Reedy, and Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thank you for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Glenn Weldon, and we'll see you all tomorrow.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Vuori, a new perspective on performance apparel. Clothing designed with premium fabrics, built to move in, styled for life. For 20% off your first purchase, go to Vuori.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
Last year, over 20,000 people joined the Body Electric study to change their sedentary, screen-filled lives. And guess what?
We saw amazing effects.
Now you can try NPR's Body Electric Challenge yourself. Listen to updated and new episodes wherever you get your podcasts.